I've got a week off, not next week, but the week after. And so my mum and dad are like, definitely come. We've got, and they're like, what a big garden. I was like, I'm not sleeping in a tent. Like, are you joking? Obviously, it's a drive up to like north of Manchester. It's not like you can go and come back in the same day. I mean, I think we probably will at this point.
Just a message for the podcast. And actually, Bryn, you can put this one in. Mira's mum and dad. Mira really does need to come and see you soon. Don't let her say no.
We know
you're allowed to see you outdoors. And I think she's even allowed to see you indoors now. She's not getting away with it.
See, now that's going to be a test for like if they actually do listen to the podcast or not.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to a long overdue episode of Somewhere in Between. I'm Anthony, and I'm back with Johannes, Hatim, and Mira for this week's edition of the podcast. After a little bit of a hiatus, it's really good to see you guys. We've all just been saying how we got so used to seeing each other every week for our catch-up, it's felt like I felt like I've been missing something for the last few weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like having my own support group, but in my living room over a screen, and I've not been having that at all, so I've been bothering my husband instead.
And your new dog as well.
Yeah, but that's more of a bonus than anything else.
And the problem is, whenever you try and bother your husband, he's too busy playing FIFA anyway.
But I'll fully blame that on Hatim, who helpfully sent me his... Well, he had a spare PS4 lying around. To those of you thinking about buying... games consoles, don't do it.
I also got a PS4 at the start of lockdown, and it's definitely made me a bit less productive, I think, over the last few months.
As I was saying earlier, we should all take a leaf out of Johannes's book and actually start cycling and being outdoors a bit more.
I'm also really old school with games. I've just started a biannual board games league with my brothers and sisters. So no PS4s here.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, well, we probably have all about 20 different board games each. So we're going to like nominate games into the league. There are trophies on the way. We're going to have like different teams, and it's all getting ridiculous, but it's going to
be actually quite amazing.
Yeah, that's going to be a weekly check-in, Johannes, to see how the Family Board Games League is going. And obviously before we get into the real meat of the episode, which we will, top three game boards? Get board games, even?
So there's one called Villagers, which was a Kickstarter project last year, which is amazing. It's a deck builder game. There's a cool dystopian futuristic game where you kind of play as a dystopian overlord trying to suppress your people, which is quite nice. I think that's called Euphoria. And then there was a really good one with wizards and spells that my sister has, but I can't remember the name. I'll come back to you with that one.
I mean, this sounds like my cup of tea. I'm so on board.
The dystopian one sounds a bit like reality, really, doesn't it?
I mean, it's definitely true. I think, since we last spoke, things have changed quite a lot. And obviously now we're able to get out and about a little bit more. But still, I think for me anyway, it's had like a definite impact on how comfortable I feel going around, like the things I actually want to do. And even though the restaurants and pubs might have opened up, I haven't quite ventured out that far yet. Although Hatim, we know that you were first in line to a restaurant when it happened.
I did not waste any time. Let's just say it was an interesting experience, and probably we'll be heading out to a restaurant this weekend as well.
I mean, I think, and what we've all agreed is that it's been a really strange shift over the last 3 or 4 months for us all, even from the way in which we're working. GP surgeries are definitely opening up a bit more, and I'm getting calls from sort of patients who are really uncertain about things or asking me about my advice on travel, and I'm perfectly honest with them, going, I don't know what I would do in these situations. So it is a bit of a strange time, and I completely can see it. It's from one side, you know, it's about the economy, it's about people's livelihoods, which directly impacts on mental health and well-being and their ability to provide. And then the other side of things of being sensible and safe, so we don't, you know, have to have local lockdowns like Leicester is going through at the moment. It's a really tricky balance to achieve, and I think GPs are going to be right amongst there in the mix of trying to hear about what's going on and help people as much as they're helping themselves and their own families as well.
Yeah, I think now in my practice, I mean, it feels kind of like back to normal in terms of like the number of contacts we're having. In some ways, I think it's actually got busier because whilst we're like doing all these remote consultations, like the actual waiting for somebody to send you a photo, like their connection breaking up over a video call, just like trying to get through to someone several times, all of that extra time adds up. And if you've got a full clinic booked now, sometimes it actually feels even more heavy going than it did before, especially now that people aren't just coming with, you know, just like a bunch of minor things. There is like all of the demand which has built up over the last few months with people delaying attending their GP or not managing certain chronic conditions as well as they might have been. We've started to get our diabetic patients back into the practice for their kind of checks and blood tests. And we're seeing loads of HbA1cs all over the place. Lots of people, understandably not taking their medicines with all of the different stresses and upheaval that's been going on in lots of different patients' lives. And now it's really about, I guess, supporting people in that type of situation to get back to their own sense of normality, which is quite a difficult thing for us all to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, go on, Johannes.
Thanks. How many of you are seeing patients with post-COVID syndrome as well? Because there's been a lot of talk about that in my practice this week and how we manage patients with kind of non-specific symptoms or ongoing symptoms.
I mean, I think we've all been really surprised by the sheer volume of people and members of the public we're speaking to, patients in our practice, who are still struggling with symptoms. And bear in mind, they may have been unwell in March or even from February half-term holidays. And since then, they still just haven't quite recovered. And it's not only patients as well, you know, it's colleagues that I've worked with, other people that I know who have had symptoms and either been relatively unwell or significantly unwell and still sort of getting a lot of the symptoms as a result of that. So I think it's something that's going to stay in our practice for a long time to come. A majority of it from the patients that I've been speaking to is a mental health aspect. People aren't sleeping very well. That's something that I'm sort of consulting on a daily basis. I don't know about you guys. And then the other thing is this overwhelming fatigue that doesn't seem to sort of improve. And, you know, reassuringly, they may have some blood tests, which are all very, very normal. But again, there is this overwhelming sense that things aren't back to normal for them from a physical health perspective or a mental health perspective. Has that been the same thing that you've experienced, Johannes?
So we've just been discussing it in the practice in general, because we're not really sure what to do with these patients. I think for a lot of them, you know, the routine panel of GP bloods that we might do as a baseline won't necessarily show anything up. And I think when they're going to, if they're being referred to a post-COVID clinic, you know, they're getting an echo or a CTPA, they're getting, or, you know, a CT chest, they're getting higher level investigations, and there's no kind of middle ground that we can initiate. So the question is just, you know, how do we gauge who needs to be referred into a post-COVID clinic, and who do we just kind of keep hold of and try and manage in primary care?
Yeah, I think it's at the minute it feels like a bit of an unanswerable question, just because there are so many unknowns and I guess like an unknown number of patients that will be suffering with the long-term implications of COVID as well. I definitely know that I'm speaking to a few people every week who have, again, persistent symptoms. And I think at the minute, we're just, at the minute, we haven't, again, in our practice, we haven't got a plan or a protocol on how to deal with those patients. It is just, at the minute, trying to contain them and continue to monitor and support them while we get some more information and I guess a kind of locally commissioned policy or guideline to be able to support them if they, you know, in the best way that we can once we get more evidence behind that. But it is a really difficult situation. I mean, just today the college has published its report on general practice in a post-COVID world and is asking GPs to write to their MPs to try and get the support that and investment that general practice needs in order to provide effective care. And I was just looking on Twitter at the post, and there's, you know, a number of patients on there that are all asking around how GPs are going to support patients with long-term symptoms related to COVID. So I think that's going to turn into a much bigger movement over time, as we see lots of patients suffering from a similar constellation of symptoms, and understandably they'll want answers and support as quickly as possible.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also, Hatem can probably weigh in on this from a secondary care perspective as well. I think there's this huge impact, not only in primary care, but also people who've had operations delayed or been put on waiting lists for various investigations and things. And obviously, indeed, there was initially a lull in A&E, but as things open up further and people are becoming more unwell and presenting to A&E with those conditions, it's about looking at that balance of what's going to happen in our secondary care services. And yeah, I think it's going to be, it's uncharted and uncertain territory. But I think the one thing that all four of us can agree on is that it's something that's not going to leave us anytime soon. And we'll be dealing with the repercussions of this initial surge, and who knows about, you know, subsequent surges and peaks for a very, very long time. I mean, Hatem, how has it been sort of for you recently in with A&E and COVID and things like that?
I think it's the same sort of issues that we're having, in terms of you do kind of worry about what happens to the follow-up of your patient. Are they going to be able to access secondary care clinics if they need it, you know, soon? Or is that access to secondary care still limited? Particularly, you know, patients like coming with a sort of chest pain, angina, need a rapid chest pain clinic, those sort of things, are they still happening? But I mean, there have been some changes in our local area in terms of a lot of referrals. In fact, I think everything except 2 week wait referrals have moved towards more of an advice and guidance type system, and I think that seems to be happening across the country. Because I think, and in a way, it's a long time coming, because what it means is actually, hopefully, we can work more efficiently by getting that advice that, you know, we need in primary care from secondary care, so that secondary care can also then filter out the patients that they need to see based on the information that, you know, we give them, and that sort of communication between the two teams and integration of care probably will only make things better in a post-COVID world.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think just touching on that point of integration of the primary and secondary care, but also collaborative working, because I think there's been a couple of patients where I've written for advice and guidance, and actually, instead of a patient going into the ether, seeing that consultant, and you getting a letter months down the line that may not even come to you, I'm hearing relatively quickly from a consultant or a registrar about what their plan would be. And it's informed my own practice, so that I know if I see similar patients in the future, I know maybe what best practice would be in that instance, or whether they need a repeat blood test and then refer, and that sort of thing. So that's definitely been helpful, to have a better conduit with secondary care through Consultant Connect and the other sort of methods that people may have regionally. And it's also really made me think about sort of the other communities that we work with as well. So our pharmacist has been working full time doing med reviews and various other things now, because that's becoming more and more apparent for people. And as you say, Anthony, you know, people with their diabetic checks, checking HbA1c, heart failures, asthma reviews, all those things never sort of stopped completely. It was always ticking on in the background, but I think pharmacists and our social prescribers are really coming into their own now, because you look at their blocks on EMIS, they're completely full. They don't have appointments for weeks. I think GP is starting up again, but probably in a bizarrely different way.
Yeah, I think I think at my practice we're just recruiting our first social prescriber, which will be good to have that at a practice level, rather than just kind of referring to somebody locally who they end up taking weeks, if not months, to see. So that'll be really good. Also, we have now finally started to talk about getting group consultations in the practice, obviously not face to face at the minute, but thinking about how we can approach communities who might traditionally be difficult for us to reach for one reason or another, might not have the same health beliefs or understanding as we do as doctors. And so being able to engage those communities effectively through community champions, as well as in collaboration with somebody from the practice in a group setting, we're thinking is going to be a really helpful addition, and something we can add particularly for people with chronic diseases. So at the minute we're thinking how we could use it specifically for our patients with diabetes, and I think that's going to be a really interesting thing that we can start working on over the coming months.
Yeah, from my discussions with my sort of education supervisors as I got to a sort of sign-off stage, is actually COVID has become a real reset for general practice. And now we can start thinking about how we want it to be in the future. And obviously, like Anthony mentioned, the college has started that discussion as well with what's come out. So It's a really unique position to be in. You know, none of us, I think, want it to completely go back to the way it was before in terms of, you know, constant 10-minute appointments, you know, access to care being really difficult for patients, and actually long waiting lists to be seen in secondary care as well. So it's a whole opportunity to completely rethink the system that we work in. And I think from the impression that I got from speaking to my supervisor was that there's a little bit of a watch and wait stage now, just to sort of assess the landscape and then think about what will happen next. And it's an interesting time to be in, sort of in general practice.
Yeah, I completely sort of echo that. And I think especially as we are all either gone past or coming to those ARCP moments, it's actually crazy how much has come along since we started talking about this podcast initially before Christmas, didn't we, really talking about what we wanted to do and where we wanted to get to. And by the time it comes around to August, we will have all sort of hopefully got through our respective years of GP training, and we'll have an influx of new GP trainees, you know, people who will go into the first five world passing a new, completely new exam that was developed so quickly, and seeing sort of the feedback from that and seeing how that goes on and what that will mean sort of for future sittings of the exam and how the college will work with trainees for that. But also our later career and retired members, there was lots of people that came back to service because of the peak and what that sort of meant to them being back in working roles or being engaged again in teaching or supervising or whatever capacity that might be in. So it is an exciting time for, I think, obviously us as AITs, but a whole spectrum of people as well who've been involved across this sort of entire time.
Yeah, and I think that notion of community is the big focus of this week's episode. So we do have an interview between myself as the chair of the AIT community, but with also Ian Wood, who's the chair of the First Five Committee, with Emma Tonner, who's one of the co-chairs of the Medical Student and Foundation Doctors Committee, and Mona Kielina, who's the chair of the Later Career and Retired Members Community, which is one of the newer community groups which has started up at the college. And I do think going into this conversation that while there have been so many difficult challenges over the last few months of COVID, now that we're reaching a stage where we can reflect and look back a little bit, actually I do think that general practice feels in a stronger position in many ways. And I think particularly when it comes to that sense of community, these challenges have really brought people together to share learning, to support one another in an even more like real way, if for want of a better word, than before. And I think that all of the groups, community groups of the college, have strengthened during the last few months as they faced their own challenges. For trainees, that's involved, you know, as we've spoken about on here many times, things like redeployment, changes to exams. And as we're recording this, we have just had the first round of the RCA submissions also closed, which I think is, you know, a massive achievement as well, to see such a big change to training happen in such a short space of time. But I think for all of us, and we're probably biased as we are AIT reps, but I think the sense of community that you can get from being a member of one of these community groups is really important and does add something to your professional life, and gives you, and also allows you to build lots of personal friendships and relationships as well, which is something, as well as many other points, that we're going to reflect on over the next few minutes in this interview. So let's take a listen.
Hi everyone, my name's Emma Tonner and I just want to introduce myself. I've just recently graduated from the University of Leeds and I'm one of the Medical Student and Foundation Doctor Community Leads alongside Aaron, Bex and Lisa Jane. I've graduated and I'm waiting to take up my academic foundation training post in Leicester in August. I've been involved in the RCGP in various ways for a number of years, but with this particular group for nearly 2 years now. And it's been a wonderful way to get involved with the college and really be a voice for medical students and foundation doctors.
Hi everyone, I'm Ian Wood, I'm a GP down in Buckinghamshire, and last November I was elected to the National First Five chair role at the Royal College of GPs. Much like Emma, I've been involved with the RCGP for some time in a number of different committees, but the First Five community are really represent just anyone who's within the first 5 years of getting their MRC GP. It's a very vibrant community. We have a representative from every faculty, in our committee. And I guess one of the key differentiators of the First Fires compared to other communities is that we represent a really mixed set of roles in the profession, probably more so than anyone else. Of course, portfolio, salary, partners, locums, military, and that makes our committees very, very varied.
Hi, I'm Mona Aquilina. I qualified in 1981, and I've been a member of the college for 35 years, since I passed my membership exam back then, when it was an optional exam. So I'm chair of the Later Career and Retired Members Group, and the reason we call ourselves Later Career and Retired Members without an age limit is actually because there isn't an age at which one joins this group. It's anyone who self-identifies as being in the later stages of their career, anyone at whatever age who's once been a GP and has retired. And we're a very young group. We've only been around formally for 18 months.
We're also a relatively new committee. And what's really exciting about the college is they've really been very much on board and really proactive with encouraging medical students and foundation doctors right up to their outreach work with even primary school children to bring forward that future generation of general practice. So it's really wonderful to see in this call represented a huge range of how well the college is supporting everybody.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to reflect on, is because I've been a rep now for coming up to 2 years, and within that 2 year period, I think I've seen a big change in the way that the college thinks about its members, different communities within its membership, and how best to represent and reflect their views in the decision making that goes on at college. Mm-hmm. So it is great. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, the three of you, for joining me to talk about kind of how communities work at the college and some of the issues facing your members. So I guess just on that, it would be really good to hear about some of the big issues that are facing kind of members of your communities at the minute. Perhaps if we kick off with Mona, because obviously with everything that's going on around COVID at the minute and returners, there must have been a huge amount of different concerns, different issues and different questions coming up from members within your community group.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. COVID has been a huge catalyst for our community. I'm delighted that the group was up and running before COVID set in, because at least we were an organized group and we were still at the stage of trying to sort of really have an identity within the college. A lot of people didn't know we existed as a group. Some GPs were saying, you know, what's the point of having a later career and retired members group? You know, the great and the good are all in their later career, or a lot of them are, and, you know, retired members are trustees, etc. But actually, this is a group that needs a lot of support. It is true that some later career and retired GPs managed to stay engaged within the GP community and the college, but a lot don't. They're just GPs, ordinary GPs, working at the coalface for 60 hours a week for 30 years. And then, you know, they retire when they plan to at 60, 65, and they find retirement a big shock. So that's why the group actually was set up in the first place, and to help GPs cope with the transition. You know, to be honest, a lot of you are younger than me, but for me, the last 30 years have passed in a flash. You know, before I know it, I'm in this category. But being a trainee or even a medical student, it feels like yesterday. And as a doctor, you get a lot of people coming to you wanting to invest your money invested or to plan for your pension, which is great. But you don't get any retirement planning from the well-being point of view. So there was a big need. So we were trying to get our identity established. And then suddenly COVID came along. And that was a real catalyst, because the GMC wrote to all these thousands of doctors, including GPs, saying, you know, can you help out? And the response was overwhelming. You know, thousands of retired GPs offered to go back. GPs in later career who had stopped working clinically but were still involved wanted to re-engage. And so the there were doctors within 5 years of retirement, but also doctors within 10 years of retirement wanted to contribute. And to have to make these big decisions, having retired once and you got used to being retired. Gosh, can I see patients again? Am I fit to practice? Am I up to date? You know, all these questions. So everyone had to make their own decisions. Obviously, we're a professional group. We don't need our tick boxes and our appraisals to know at what stage we're at. And it's a very personal decision, friends and family. We had to discuss it with friends, partners, families, what to do. And some returners have chosen to go back to clinical work to help with the COVID assessment service. Through mentoring and supporting GPs and other doctors through mentoring and coaching, because a lot of our group are trained coaches and mentors. Some doctors have chosen to just be contact tracers. Some doctors, retired doctors, are just sewing face masks and scrubs. And others are helping out in the local communities. They're linked with charities anyway, doing outreach work. And as a group, and I'll let you know the others speak in a minute, but as a group, COVID has helped us launch a lot of remote events, local events. So there are about 18 later career leads, and we set up remote events so people can just Zoom into meetings, and the meetings are well attended. We've had between 20 and 30 people at local meetings. Lots of people haven't engaged with the college. We've told GPs, retired GPs, later career GPs who left the college or were never members to join us. So there's all this energy, and I'll talk about the problems later, but at the moment it's vastly positive, and all this energy from beyond has been unleashed, actually. I'm happy to answer any questions because I could go on for hours, but I'm sure you don't want me to.
Well, I think that's really positive to kind of hear about is the amount of energy there, and also thinking around, you know, how people can use the amazing skills that they've developed for a whole career in general practice to continue to help people, even if they're not practicing clinically anymore. I think that's a really important thing to think about. I guess at the other end of the spectrum is Emma, in your position, you've just finished medical school, just waiting to start your first job as a foundation doctor. And I guess for everybody who's a member of your kind of community group as well, has been in a similar position where if you're a medical student, and also for foundation doctors, they've been affected in terms of not rotating through jobs. Lots of other concerns around being able to progress were initially thrown up in the air. Is there any other kind of big issues that you've been hearing from your members?
So I think the biggest thing has been how we're not good at dealing with change at the best of times. I think it's been really unsettling for medical students and foundation doctors. Medical students have had their placements and electives altered or cancelled. They've had online teaching, maybe even taken online exams or had their assessments changed. Medical students have then taken up roles as volunteers in their local communities, as healthcare assistants or in specially designed physician roles or new interim FY1 posts or a number of other ways. And it's adapting to that change and realising how people can help. And I think that was very unsettling for quite a while as these roles and volunteering opportunities are being created. I do think that settled down a bit. I certainly think it's worth mentioning that there are a lot more opportunities to volunteer in secondary care. They were much easier for people to access, but that actually medical students are a huge asset to primary care during COVID-19 and the pandemic, whether that's helping triage in a number of other ways in primary care. And it's really important if GP surgeries or if people could think of ways for medical students to volunteer, that they advertise those opportunities, because we know that medical students' placements make up 81% of their perceptions of general practice. And as they're not having those placements at the moment, it's really good if we can get students into GP practice in different ways. Just before all of this happened, we were doing a lot of work lobbying the Department of Health and trying to increase the amount of placements that medical students were getting in primary care. we wanted that to be 50%, and it was nowhere near in a lot of cases. And we're really worried that after all this has happened, that it'd be very difficult to get placements up and running in the same way again, and that some of the good work that's been done and the progress that's being made might be reversed or not progress any further than it has. So I think that's a really important message to say. I think foundation doctors have got entirely different issues. They're worried about things like their annual leave, moving rotas, having not had their rotation, perhaps not getting that career insight into their general practice that they wanted. And it's really important as a community that we're helping to support those doctors make important career decisions and give them an insight into general practice in whatever way we're able, virtually, through potentially thinking about ways that we can provide electives or career insights, collating some of those tools and resources that we already have into accessible ways that people can access and are most relevant to them at the moment. I think that's really important, certainly, that we try and promote general practice as a really flexible, innovative career and all the wonderful things that have come out of it. The advances in technology, the flexibility, all these things are wonderfully attractive to future GPs. And actually, we want to provide people with a really accurate insight into what general practice is like so they can make that decision whether it's the right thing for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely my experiences at medical school of general practice were mixed, but definitely the final few placements that I had were some of the main kind of formative experiences that probably led to me eventually choosing to go into general practice. So I think that's, you know, it sounds like you guys were doing amazing work before COVID, and I do hope that that will all be able to continue as things settle down and we return to some sort of new normality anyway.
I hope the focus on population health and public health and health inequalities and all these questions that have been raised by the news and in the general public domain at the moment really keep at the forefront so that the curriculum changes in that way that we can have a more holistic, better community-based response to people's health.
Yeah. And then in the middle of all of this, so after Emma finishes medical school, after FY1's enter GP training, after I finish GP training, I'll then be becoming a first five and entering into your community, Ian. And as you said, you represent a really diverse group of people with a huge number of different roles across primary care and other sectors as well. And I guess it's difficult to pinpoint specific issues which are specific just to first fives. But I know, for example, that there was you had a recent talk on the issues that are affecting locums. And I know that there are a lot of similar issues to that, which have impacted on all GPs, not necessarily just first fives. But is there any specific things that you're particularly concerned about that are affecting, you know, large numbers of your members at the minute?
Yeah, so absolutely, Anthony. It's really interesting to hear both Mona and Emma speak about what challenges they're facing. And I suppose it's no surprise that the R4 communities are arisen all around points of transition in careers. And any points of transition, as Emma alluded to, it creates worry and anxiety with any change. And although we've got varying degrees of experience amongst our four groups, actually, I think we're all struggling with the same issues, really. Issues affecting around well-being, around worry about change, what work will look like tomorrow, what work will look like in a year's time, and also the job security that comes with that, or the outlook for the roles we're taking on, certainly in Mona's case. So many of the reflections that we've already touched on are shared by the first fives. I'll particularly pick up on locums. We have a really high proportion of locum membership in the first five community. I think on the last count, it was almost up to about 50% do some degree of locum work or identify themselves as a locum GP. And it's a voice that we've really got to make sure is resonates loudly within the college and forming that higher proportion of our membership. And it's a very unique role being a locum. And it has, there's a lot of preconceptions about the kind of doctors who go into do locum work as a career, but they fulfil a really unique and valuable role within the profession, you know, being able to be adaptable and responsive to surges in demand and need for work. So we've got to do more to support them. Now, a lot of the issues which locum members face tend to be contractual, which obviously sits outside of sort of RCGP's remit, but we certainly can help to make that voice heard. But a big proportion of what we can do is around well-being, you know, and looking after those members. It can be a very isolating career being a locum GP and can be quite a lonely experience. So actually making sure we're bringing people together. So unfortunately not physically anymore, but virtually, as our last night's webinar brought a lot of members together for just that reason, but virtually and also through groups when people are moving to areas. So, you know, first five, another transition point, you're often moving into a new region, might get a new house, setting up a new family. Actually bringing people together, forming new networks when they're moving is key to that as well, key to their well-being. And that really is particularly felt a lot by our locum doctors. So we're trying to do a lot to try and support them. And also that's being heard as well in the RCGP members forum. There's a really loud presence now of local members there airing the concerns that they've got. So it's a really valuable place for them to get heard.
Yeah, I think I think kind of our roles as community group chairs and of the community groups as a whole is all around providing that voice to people, allowing them a different sense of community, particularly like you say, in some job roles, which might be a bit more lonely, and also just making sure that groups that might not necessarily have the opportunity to offer their views or opinions into the college traditionally have that option and can influence kind of the future of the profession and have some of their specific needs met, even if those needs don't necessarily lie 100% within the remit of the college. Having a kind of focused central group where people can get together and share those experiences is really important.
I mean, that's definitely true, Anthony. I think another big calling from the first five group, if you like, has been notion about flexible working, which I suspect is what drives a lot of people to pursue a locum career, or certainly locum important in the career. Traditionally, primary care has struggled to adopt drastic changes to enable flexible working amongst young professionals, young families and the like. But with COVID, we've, as Mona said, we've seen this be a real catalyst of flexible working, actually. You know, it's been scaled and implemented because of necessity more than actually because of wants. But the benefits now, we have to make sure we distill those down and we keep the discussions going. Now, it's been long called for in the first five groups. And there have been many kind of often very understandable reasons and barriers why they haven't been able to change and be more flexible. But actually, we've got an opportunity now to really, you know, drive up the quality and the volume of the workforce who could work and continue working in a more flexible way.
Yeah.
And I think what Ian said, the flexibility is really attractive for future GPs or potential GPs coming into a career, that actually general practice is a really innovative place. It can be a really flexible place. And if we can embrace this change in the way we've used technology and the way that we interact with patients, I think that's a really good thing. I think there's lots of other positives we can take from this, particularly things like the primary and secondary care interface. As a community, we're very passionate about sort of getting rid of specialty bashing. 76% of students have encountered negativity towards general practice from academics, clinicians, or educational trainers. It's very much embedded within the health system, and it's not unique to general practice. But actually, some really positive things have come from this, and we need to work really hard to try and embrace these positive new changes and move forward with them to a better healthcare system for everyone.
Yeah.
May I also make the point about how important flexibility is and always has been? When I qualified as a GP in 1985, the norm was to do 90% of people were full-time, and the norm was to do 10 sessions a week plus on-call. And when a friend and I applied for a job share in general practice, they laughed at us. This was a professorial teaching general practice. They said, "Why do you not want a job share? You're not married, you know. Why can't you do full-time work?" This was typical of the attitude at the time. And the only reason that a lot of people didn't do locums in those days was because not only was it frowned upon much more than it is nowadays, was if you did locum work, it wasn't pensionable. And what it meant was that a lot of GPs, especially women GPs, just left the workforce in their 30s. Because if they couldn't, either they had to work full-time and get a nanny. A few of my friends had very caring partners, husbands who were willing to give up their jobs and look after the children. So, you know, this was a different era. So, I mean, but people, humans are the same. And I think the need for flexibility has always been there. And COVID, another change is suddenly working from home used to be frowned upon. Now, from COVID, working from home because of safety issues has become the norm. So I'm not saying that that should be the norm forever, but certainly I think there should be a lot more flexibility for people who need to work from home sometimes at all career stages, I think.
I think that's a really interesting...
Because the needs are different, yeah.
I think that's a really interesting reflection, Mona. And actually, you can see that the college it represents that new norm, if you like. And you can't find an officer at the college really who doesn't have what we now call a portfolio career and has a large degree of flexibility in the way in which they work. That's really encouraging to see, because actually that's what a lot of our first five members especially are choosing to adopt as their way of working. And so I think the college is certainly leading by example when it comes to how to try and balance that work-life balance a little bit better than possibly it was before, as you just alluded to.
Yeah, and I think definitely from my point of view as a kind of trainee rep, at the minute the college has just stopped, finished collecting evidence for a new consultation on the world post-COVID-19. And definitely one of the big things that was coming up from trainees when we were asking them for their views on this was, again, all around flexibility, being able to have more autonomy over how they work, having more control over the kind of structure of their day. And everyone was kind of on board of thinking that this is but hopefully a great way to start reshaping the normal structure of a GP's average day in a clinic, and also thinking about preventing burnout and I guess at the end of the day improving retention of GPs. So it's great to hear that actually this is something that's, like Mona says, this is something that affects GPs at all career stages, has always been an issue, and hopefully now we're continuing to move in a positive direction to overcome some of those hurdles. In terms of you guys' experience as a rep, what was it that made you want to get more involved with work that the college was doing? What was your kind of journey up until that point? And how have you kind of adjusted to taking on an additional role in addition to everything else that you're doing over the last however many months to years that you've all been reps? Maybe if we start with Emma on that one.
So I originally got involved through our local GP society at the University of Leeds. We hosted the first student medical conference back then. Now we have wonderful Discover GP conferences every year, and it's wonderful to see how many students and foundation doctors are so engaged. That developed into a number of different working groups, bringing together medical students from all over the country, and it was primarily medical students that got involved. We're really keen to branch out and have as many foundation doctors as possible. And it's something as a community we've struggled to engage with to the same extent because of rotas and because actually medical students are very accessible in their GP societies. But actually getting foundation doctors when they're involved in training and busy rotas, when they're not in distinct packages of areas to access, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And actually, what we did was try to create this group of interested medical students and foundation doctors to be a real voice to advocate for what the future of general practice might want and what that might look like. And we really wanted to open those conversations up about what the future will be like, to provide career insights, to provide events, to get a really accurate representation of what general practice is so that people can make a decision that's right for them about their future career. And that what really wasn't covered at the time, and we've come a huge way since the beginning. And I've just increasingly got more and more involved, and love doing it. So I haven't found it, although it takes time, and I love it. And you always find a way to balance things in your life.
And we hope that when the time comes, you will eventually actually apply for GP training as well.
I think the whole world will be very surprised.
And then Ian, same question to you. So kind of what's been your journey to becoming chair of the first five committee?
Yeah, so I started off, I wanted to get involved in my faculty, and I've always been a key believer in being involved in system-wide change, being able to trying to influence positively on a much wider population than we reach through our patients. So I tried to get involved with our faculty and became one of the treasurers, a board member for our local faculty in Thames Valley, which was a fantastic experience, and being able to you know, I really enjoy our faculty meetings and being able to feed into key programs of work that or policy which really do change not just the profession but the public as well at a four nation scale, and I find that really rewarding. And the opportunity came up to be first right representative locally, which I was very keen to do, so we start planning some more events and help that bridging period between training and starting your fully qualified profession in general practice. We've had some fantastic first five chairs prior to me, some big boots to fill. They led it to the first five boys to be very, very prominent, promoter of change for good within the college, making our voice heard. And I'm very keen to continue that. They led on some really good movements to both digitise both the college and the profession. And also on wellbeing as well. And I was just keen to continue that. It really is a pleasure to represent our group. We've got a fantastic committee, and that's one of the main ways that I managed to balance my time well, is that we've got a committee and people are very keen to be involved in different areas of the college that the first five representatives sit. And we work together and meet regularly, regularly and for brief times is what I find works best to get feedback and to move forward. And it really is a fantastic community to be part of. Anyone who is in any doubt when they're becoming a newly qualified GP, reaching out to the established first five networks it should be a really helpful experience for anyone.
Definitely. And Mona, as with Emma, your community group is one of the newer ones. You said you've been going for about 18 months. What's been the process with that development? How did you come to be involved in that? And I guess, how did you come to be the chair of that group as well?
Okay. Well, I was there at the beginning, really. As I said earlier, I never really job shared until my last few years in practice. But I was a full-time partner for most of my career, clinical career. And I was also a GP trainer. In 30 years of practice, I just took a 6-month sabbatical. That was my only time off to refresh myself. So I planned my retirement because I was running a business, you know, general practice as a partner. It's a business. And I couldn't see myself flourishing further. I'd reinvented myself as a trainer. I'd done all sorts of things. But I thought, while I stay in the practice, I can't be innovative. For example, I had an interest in looking after homeless patients. And I there wasn't an option to do that within the practice. And so it was a planned retirement. But what I discovered is when I left the practice and gave myself a 6-month sabbatical, I found that there was very little support other than, you know, just go and do a locum and do your own thing. So there weren't any innovative schemes out there for later career GPs. I'm under my own steam. I found a locum job in a practice looking after homeless patients. I also trained as a mentor and started mentoring doctors. I also volunteered, and I'm still doing this work. I love doing it. I'm a tutor to refugee doctors now, international medical graduates who need to pass their PLAB exams. And it's been a wonderful experience to meet these doctors all over the world, have suffered persecution and wars and dreadful things, really. So I managed to work a few, you know, to sort of find roles for myself, but it was jolly hard work. So I went to conference 6 months after I retired and said, "Oz, what are you doing for people like me who are in transition?" Because I found this really hard work, you know, finding new roles. And they said, "Oh, we're not doing much, but join our working group. We have got a retired doctors working group, retired doctors group, and we're looking at, you know, at what, you know, what should we do in the future? So I joined this retired doctors working group, which wasn't leads or anything. They were just the representatives from the various regions were called. So many of them were provosts. And the working group met for 2 years. And it was decided at the end of those 2 years that there was a case for a later career group to be set up as a first five group already existed. So we had our first committee meeting in January 19, and then I took over as the retired previous chair. We co-chaired the first meeting, then I took over as chair in May last year. And, you know, leads were appointed from each faculty board. And so far, we've got 18 leads across the UK. And actually, it's been wonderful because I've met all these, some in later career, some retired GPs, but a lot, you know, none of them are playing golf all the time or twiddling their thumbs. They're all involved, either they're working clinically or they're mentors or they're educators, or they're appraisers, or they're a bit of everything, but they're all passionate about general practice. The sad thing is that since we've taken over as leads, we've discovered a great loneliness out there, because a lot of GPs, once they retire from their practice, I retired at the right time. I wasn't burnt out when I retired, you know what I mean? I had a bit of energy to go and do my own thing. But a lot of GPs have worked flat out for 30 or 40 years, you know, then just say, that's it. And then after 6 months, they think, gosh, oh, I missed that. I missed the patients. I've got transferable skills and there's nothing for them to go back to. So there was a big gap there, which I hope we're filling now. We're working on it anyway, because these roles don't exist. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is great. And definitely my overall kind of lasting memory of this experience of being a trainee rep has all been about the connections that I've had the opportunity to make, not just with other trainees around the country, but other GPs at all different career stages as well. And I think that as the college continues to focus on all those community groups, that sense of one big family under the umbrella of the college is something that I'd really like to see continue to develop as well.
That's been really important for the medical students and the foundation doctors is actually feeling part of a team so early in your career is a really nice feeling. Actually, we know some AITs and we know some first fives and you know some of the later career members, and actually there is a big community of people that you can go and talk to and ask for advice and learn about different people's careers and where your career might go in the future as a result of conversations that you've had or events that you attended. And I think that's a really nice thing. That I echo what you said, Anthony.
Definitely. And I guess if you guys were going to give some, perhaps Emma, you can't give some advice to trainees, but Mona and Ian, if you were going to give a piece of advice to trainees around their future careers, is there anything specific that you think people should either think about or consider when they're planning their next steps as the important transition to becoming a qualified GP approaches?
So for me, one of the big ones is what you've just been talking about, is about forming those relationships, forming them early and looking after those relationships and maintaining them even when you reach different transition phases. A lot of us, even through training, your VTS schemes, you'll have a close group of friends you've been working with, you've been rising with, been playing with as well. And to then go out into the wider working world, often those connections can get tested and they can sometimes drop off. It's a real shame, because actually many people do get a really close sense of friendship and support from their colleagues from those groups. So really nurture those relationships and try and maintain as best you can and look after each other, because actually everyone throughout their career at many stages will have challenging moments, and having a team of people you can draw upon when times are tough is so very important. We see far too many young first five members struggling with mental health and burnout even at a young age, and it's really sad to see. So all you can do to gear yourself up to be more resilient in many ways is the biggest tip I can give.
Thanks, Ian. And Mona, any words of advice?
Yeah. One practical tip is set up a practitioners group. I got involved with what was called a young practitioners group 30 years ago, and we're still meeting 30 years later, although we've had to rename ourselves because we still call ourselves the YPG amongst ourselves. But it's been a wonderful support group, because whatever practice you're in, whatever environment you're in, there are always going to be problems. And just meeting once a month for the last 30 years has made us laugh at the end of a long day, has put things in perspective, and we've bounced ideas off each other, an utterly confidential group. And I would recommend the time spent. So that's one thing. Two, choose a practice or an environment where you fit in, where you feel comfortable with the group, because I think teamwork is so important. And finally, I would say don't do too much too soon. I think it's great to have a portfolio career and follow your heart. Don't do things that don't give you happiness. But don't do too much too soon, because just seeing patients, just the clinical contact with patients is such hard work. Sometimes it's, you know, you do need to recover. You do need space, your family, friends, yourself. And, you know, don't overwhelm yourself. I still say that to myself now. Whether I practice what I preach, I'm not sure. But there you go.
And Emma, if you have some advice, just generally of your experiences, that is great. But also, you've got the three of us here. Do you have any questions about general practice, or is there anything particularly that is exciting you about kind of your future in general practice at the minute?
I think as a community, we just wanted to wish the best to all of the trainees and all of those who are working and volunteering at the moment. Advice? Personal advice is I would say that you can make any event virtual. I've attended conferences, events where, you know, family fortunes, countdown, quizzes. You can make anything virtual and just make sure that you keep having fun. I think that one piece of advice that I got, which I think I'll definitely take into the workplace, is having non-negotiable things. So things that you personally really enjoy doing, at the point in which work starts to take over or something else starts to take over and you stop doing that, that's the moment just to take a check on things. And that's something that I'm definitely going to take forward, and conversations that I've had with GPs. Questions to ask you.
Putting you on the spot, sorry.
No, it's fine. I just think it's a really exciting time, and actually it's changing hugely. And I think just that actually medical students and foundation doctors really want to be part of that conversation, and that if people come up to you and ask you questions, just be as open and honest with the answers as you can, and open up those discussions about both the positives and the challenges of a career in general practice. They're some of the most valuable conversations that I've had as I've sort of explored my own career insights, is actually, I thought this might be challenging and I've explored it with somebody who's been through it, and then I understand it better, and actually I can make an informed decision about my career. I found that a really useful thing to do. I don't really have any questions per se, but I would like to say thank you for the support of all of the officers and everybody at the college, and all of the membership team, you know, Chris, Rebecca, Bryn, Evie, because they've enabled us as a community to do some really exciting things. And I'm sure that's the same for Ian, Mona, and yourself, Anthony. And I think it's important to say, in the context of actually all the exciting things that have been going on, a little bit of a positive note.
Definitely. And I guess just as we kind of close up, do you guys have just a couple of words just around the future? Any specific things that you'd like to say to the members that you represent, or any wishes that you have for the future of general practice? Quite a lot to fit into just a few lines, but any closing words that you'd like to give to people listening? Mona, why don't we kick off with you?
Okay, well, I would like to say, for those doctors who have returned to help out with the COVID crisis and have been asked to help, you know, return in the long term, again, just follow your heart, it's very different returning to help in an emergency. It's as if someone's collapsed on a plane and you've gone over to help. And, you know, because you're the only doctor on the plane. It's true we've got skills which we mustn't take for granted. We've got to utilize these skills. But I think whether you stay on in whatever role, clinical or non-clinical, long-term, it's got to be a very personal choice. And, you know, follow your heart and talk to your loved ones.
Yeah, so I mean, I want a big thank you to all the first five members and the first five GPs out there who are continuing to often be at the front of innovation in their practices or in the profession as well. I think, as we mentioned earlier about flexible working, there are a number of issues which have been called for quite a while by the first five community and now thrust into action. Things like, you know, remote working is a really welcome I think step forward for the profession, but we have also got to be mindful of some things which we don't want to lose. You know, the benefits we get from face-to-face interactions, both with patients but also with other staff members. Actually, for morale, it is actually really nice to go to work and see others. So, and we need to make sure that all these positive things come from COVID, that we need to take a step back and not lose some of the really valuable things we've had before. And I know that the first fives are championing that in their regions.
I think that I just want to say how amazed I've been at what has been achieved during very difficult times by everybody at the moment. And echo my thanks to everyone who's working and volunteered. I think for medical students and foundation doctors, I think it is a really difficult time and things are changing very rapidly and it's very unsettling. And to have that so early in your career, it's okay if that's a bit difficult at times and it's okay if you're struggling, but to reach out to all the people who are more than happy to help you. There's an amazing sense of teamwork and camaraderie, people working on different wards in different ways, people utilising the practice team in different ways. It's wonderful. And use that positive energy around you. I know people who still wanted to revise for their exams or write lots of papers during this time, but it's okay just to step back and have a break. And that's really important too.
And I think we can all probably sympathise with that, perhaps doing too much at times and recognising that we, the four of us, also need to take a break from time to time as well. For me personally, obviously, you know, on the podcast, we spoke a lot about what trainees have been going through and always giving our thanks to everything that you guys have been having so much patience through, particularly around lots of the exam issues we've had in recent months. But for me personally, I also just want to say a massive thanks to the three of you, not just for giving us your time this afternoon, but also just for everything you're doing to really drive the college in a new direction, which is member-led, thinking about the views of your communities and being more reactive to them as well. So thanks to all of you for your time today and for everything that you're doing during what is a really difficult set of circumstances. Okay, so just listening back to it, I really enjoyed the chance to speak with Ian, Mona and Emma. I've got to know them all quite well over the last months to years of being a rep, and we don't often get a chance to all sit down together and talk though, so it's always nice to hear their reflections. I particularly enjoyed listening to Mona's kind of experiences throughout her career, reflecting on how things have changed, but how something that remains permanent throughout life as a GP is that sense of community and belonging to a professional group and having so much in common with your colleagues. So I really enjoyed it, and I hope that everybody listening enjoyed it as well. One thing that we didn't touch on in that conversation is that, as well as AITs and first fives and medical students and foundation doctors and later careered and retired members and everybody else at different career stages in between, we also have other community groups which are growing and thriving at the college. So I'm a member of the LGBT group at the college, which was founded now about 18 months ago, and has been really interesting to be involved in that, working on some of the specific health inequality challenges that are faced by the LGBT community. But one of the newest groups of the college is the BAME community group. And with everything that's happening in regards to everything that's happening in the US after George Floyd, everything that's happened with the Black Lives Matter movement, and everything that is ongoing, specifically in GP training, where we have lots of international medical graduates. There's often been complaints about differential attainment. This community group is going to be really important, and it's so essential that they have got up and running at the college now. And something that has come out of recent council meetings is the sense that the college does need to be doing much more to address the specific needs of the BAME community. And so the college has been working with members of the BAME community group over the last few months to put together a specific action plan, which tries to start to address some of those challenges over the next months to years. So they've got a few different short and long-term goals. The plan is going to be signed off at the next RCGP council meeting, hopefully, and then we'll be able to start to be put in action. Within it, there are lots of different elements. I'm not going to share it all now because some of it will probably be revised, but they do have specific areas focusing on training and education, particularly, again, addressing those issues around differential attainment, the specific needs of international medical graduates, making sure that they're supported, as well as that we have a diverse pool of examiners who equally reflect the makeup of general practice, equally kind of specific CPD resources, representation at all levels of the college. So at the minute, obviously within the senior leadership team, there aren't any BAME GPs, which is an issue, definitely. And within council, there is kind of better representation in council, but something that does need to definitely be improved upon. And equally within the trustee board at college, it's been recognised that there aren't any BAME people there. Also, all of these elements of the college are predominantly middle-aged white men, so that's something that, again, we know that's not the case in terms of general practice as a whole, and we definitely do need better representation throughout the college, and as we know, all kind of senior leadership roles within medicine and healthcare. So I think those are like additional community groups that we didn't get a chance to talk about, but I know are super important, and lots of people listening will want to be hearing about the proactive steps the college is taking to address some of the challenges that they're facing as well.
I mean, yeah, I don't think that the rest of us can say anything in addition to that. I think we obviously in future episodes want to talk a bit more about our communities. We want to talk more to trainees and, you know, people who are qualified from around the country as well. And we're hoping to get a few more segments of sort of what's going on with trainees and reps from around the nation as well. And I think another important thing is about people may be listening and wondering how they can get involved with communities. And there are so many ways in which to do this, whether it's through the RCGP forum that exists at the moment, and then also being a rep. I mean, I'll probably just slide it over to Anthony because he'll say it and put it much more eloquently than I can right now. But in terms of getting involved with communities, Ant, go.
I guess there's a multitude of different ways you could go about it. So for lots of people, they'd like to engage in their local area. So getting in touch with your faculty is always a great opportunity. And as part of the BAME action plan, and as well as that, some of the LGBT aims as well are to get specific LGBT or BAME reps on most faculty boards to ensure that there is representation there. So that's one way to do it. And most faculty boards have an AIT rep, a first five rep, a later careers rep, and then people from all stages of career within that, and also representation from partners, from salaried doctors, from locum doctors. So that's a really good way to do it locally, is just get in touch with your local faculty, talk about ways that you can get involved. They're always looking for people who are keen and interested to play a part in what's happening locally. And then within that, obviously there's kind of things which are more central. So all of our AIT reps feed into kind of the national story and the bit and the kind of central work that's going on. Equally, members of the first five committee, the later career retired members, all feed into that kind of central work as well, and get to contribute to college policy, to new programs of work. So you can either approach somebody in your local faculty, or you can get in touch centrally and then work out if there's a way that you can get involved as well. And you can find most of those details on the RCGP website if you do want to contact somebody centrally. And obviously, if you're an AIT listening to this, you can always contact us on the AIT email address. So that's ait.chair@rcgp.org.uk, or you can obviously get in touch with any of us on Twitter as well.
I was going to apologize for putting you on the spot like that, but I don't feel like I need to because that was very eloquently put. So thank you.
A well-rehearsed script, yeah.
It's your answer phone message now, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, I think it's for me, you know, this is now a good 7, nearly 8 months, I think, into being chair. So in some ways, coming towards the end point of my year in role, and it's definitely been a really interesting year and one which, you know, I do feel really positively about the time that I've been in role so far. I think that we've got a really good group of reps together, but more broadly I've definitely seen trainees come together on some of the real big issues, particularly exams, over the last few months. And so I think it for me has been really nice to feel like an important part of that development, and hopefully you guys feel that you've been able to take part in that a bit as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think community is something that's going to be important to all of us over the coming months more than ever before. And I hope that listening to the words from Ian, Mona, Emma, and myself have given you just an insight into some of the work the college is doing to try and foster that sense of community amongst GPs at all different career stages. And like we say, if you would like to get more involved in the community groups at the college, then you can get in touch with us anytime. We're really looking to continue to grow these groups and to see them thrive in the future as well.
And speaking of communities, I think we found quite an apt way to end the podcast, I think, this episode.
Yeah, so we are going to end. It was obviously the 72nd birthday of the NHS very recently. And we have found a video from the NHS Chorus 19, which is a group that was set up at the beginning of lockdown to lift the spirits of NHS staff. It has over 1,000 members now who rehearse every week over YouTube. And they came together to bring their voices to cover Over the Rainbow in celebration of 72 years of the NHS. And this particular performance of the virtual choir had 237 NHS staff singing, which I think is going to be interesting to hear and watch. So that's this week's episode of Somewhere in Between. Thank you so much for listening as always, and we will be back next time for another episode. See you then. Bye guys.
Bye. Enjoy your trip to the restaurant.
Great. Good to see you guys.
Yeah, it's nice to see everyone.
I know. We can do like a Nando's visit again soon.
Yeah.
Look at we can go sit next to each other, lick each other's chicken, it's fine.